What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having seven kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Bob Leftsetz podcast. My guest today is singer, political, rock on tour, troubadour, Billy Bragg. Billy, glad to have you here.
Great to be here, Bob.
Okay, now you're in here for a three-night stand at the Troubadour, and each night is different material. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's really something that I developed over the last 18 months. Last time I came through town, through Los Angeles, I was on a fly-play tour, which is basically every day you fly and play. That's harder than it used to be. I mean, partly because I'm over 60 now, so it's harder on me.
Well, let's just be clear. How old are you?
I'm 61.
Okay.
But also, the airlines don't operate the way they used to. I think it's a mixture of their corporate attitude, but also the weather is much more inclement than it used to be. And it only takes a storm in the Midwest to knock their schedules out a little bit, and you're in danger of losing a gig. I know agents who won't book bands who've played in Nashville a gig the very next day in New York because the possibility of them missing the gig because the flights are cancelled is too high. So when you take all that into account, you need to try and think about a new way of touring. And for me, I got invited to play at the Horseshoe Tavern in Toronto a couple of years ago, three-night stand there for their 75th anniversary. And I used to play there a lot in the 80s. And I came up with this idea that the first night I would play my current touring set, which is, songs right across my career. The tour, the show I did last time I was in town, the show I would do if I was just doing one night in a city. But on the second night, I would only play songs from my first three albums.
Just for those who are uninitiated, how many albums do you have?
I don't know, 12, 13.
Okay.
That's what you count.
So yeah. Just from the first three
first
albums.
First three, yeah. So that would take me up to about 1986. And then on the third night, the final night, I would only play songs from my second three albums. So that would take me up to 1994. So classic early Bragg and then the sort of poppy middle period. And it's kind of interesting for me because I think for a lot of younger audiences, it was Mermaid Avenue Project with Wilco that put me onto their radar.
When you did Mermaid Avenue.
Yeah, that was around the turn of the century. But those earlier records play into the crowd that kind of got into me through college radio. And they're the people who are coming along. And I can tell it's them because the middle night, the first three albums always sells out first.
That was my question. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And the other two eventually sell out. But
which do you enjoy playing the most?
It depends what kind of mood I'm in. I think the first three album stuff is is exciting. You got to remember, Bob, my first album was only 17 minutes long.
Right.
I can and have played it as an encore, the whole album. I don't need to rent the Royal Albert Hall and get an orchestra. I can just bash it out if I feel like it. But having said that, in the context that we're currently in, the political context, a lot of those songs still resonate. But then the second three records, when I was laughingly trying to be a pop star,
right?
They're interesting to kind of reconnect with as well. And the last of those three albums, William Bloke, is my kind of parenthood record. And it's always nice to go back to that sort of rebirth.
Now, even you, you're a third generation, or depending on how we want to count it, you're not the Beatles, you're not a 70s act. But in today's scattered landscape, where it's hard for anybody to get traction, does that affect your motivation to write songs and record songs?
It does. It's not so much the traction, it's the cost as an independent artist behind making a full-blown album that can actually engage in the mainstream on Spotify. Mm-hmm. The last album I made, which was recorded here in Los Angeles at Joe Henry's place, I recorded that album in a week, and then I had to spend a year earning a war chest to take it on the road with the band, because it felt to me that if I wanted to step up a level, it would need a band. But yeah, I spent a year. I had to wait with the album and spend a year getting together the money, because I have no record company behind me. I do have a record company called Cooking Vinyl, but I have a kind of licensing deal with them, so I pay for the records, I pay for the promotion, and as a result, I own my back catalogue. So yeah, it's a putting out a full service album is a big ask in terms of blood and treasure.
Okay,
and you can't do it every couple of years.
And now, if you did it with Joe Henry, how much did it cost?
Oh, it cost like a proper album. I shouldn't really say how much it cost, but it did cost a full blown
six figures.
Well,
close
no,
to
not
there.
Quite. Not quite. No.
Oh, okay.
No,
so we get the ballpark.
No,
price
not
there.
Quite. But a lot of money for me, I have to say, for someone
of
like
course,
myself.
Of course, you have to make the money.
Yeah,
just
but also, Bob, you should know that I've always made a living doing gigs. I've seldom made a huge living selling records. I had some gold records in the UK in the 80s, which is 100,000 copies. But really, my bread and butter is doing gigs.
Okay, but what about the concept of recording with the band and economically going out solo? Or do you felt that the only way to do justice to this material was to have a full band?
Yeah, the only reason to make a full service album is to try and push what you're doing up a notch, to get to slightly larger theaters, to get to slightly broader audience, to try and reach out. There's no point in just going in and just doing whatever you want to do. You've got to have to think, what do I want to achieve with this record? So getting the band together was part of that. You know, I did a 13-week North American bus tour, which I've never done before. And I think I needed to show that I was still willing to at least have a crack at making things a bit bigger.
So now that was said and done, do you believe you achieved your goal of widening your audience?
I think I achieved my goal of broadening people's perception of who I am and what I do. Working with Joe was really...
How'd you hook up with Joe?
I've known him for years. I've always been a big fan of his. And whenever I bumped into him, he's always said, you could come and make an album in my basement for a week. And towards the end of 2011, my mum had passed away in the March of 2011. And I really needed to, not for any other reason than just I needed to do something else. And I'd sort of cleared her house out, I'd sorted out the will and everything, her estate, and I needed to have a project to do. And my partner suggested, he said, why don't you go and see Joe, make a record with Joe? And that seemed like a great idea to do. But working with Joe kind of brought me a lot closer to the nascent Americana scene, because he's got good connections in that department. So I was Americana Music Association invited me to Nashville to give an award. Obviously, I had some connection there with the Wilco Woody Guthrie thing, but they invited me to come along, and I'm happy to be part of that. Obviously, it's like my relationship with folk music in England. I'm not of the folk scene. I'm not of Americana, but I am in some ways part of it.
Well, today anyway, with everybody, with the evolution of these scenes.
Yeah, and I think Americana is a good place for singer-songwriters now. I know a lot of British
Maybe the only place.
Possibly, yeah. A lot of British singer-songwriters are looking to shift to Nashville or go to Nashville to look for work. So that's a positive thing, I think.
Okay, now when you came in, you just said you got off the Kiomo cruise.
Talking of Americana.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about what that experience was like.
Well, I've never been on a cruise ship before, so the idea of going out on one sounds a bit strange, but when you think—
Okay, just so I know, I have been on a few cruise ships. Did Kiomo have the entire ship?
Yeah, the entire ship.
And do you remember what the name of the brand was, you know, Holland America, Princess?
Yeah, the Norwegian Pearl. We were on the Norwegian Pearl.
Okay. I have actually been on a Norwegian ship, and it was gigantic.
Like a city block sailing around the Caribbean. And my partner, Juliet, was actually born in the Caribbean. She was born in Trinidad, and she'd never been back there, so she wanted to come. And she's also my manager, so that made a lot of sense. And for some reason, which I can't understand, my son suddenly decided he wanted a roadie for me. Okay. So he came as well, and we had the best time. We had a really great time. There must have been about, I would say, maybe 30 to 40 artists, most of them solo artists. The headline acts were Jason Isbell and his 400 Unit? His band, Emmylou Harris was there, Keb Mo, Indigo Girls, and a lot of other great North American and some European singer-songwriters. And about, I think there was probably about 1,200 punters on the boat with us.
Okay, so how many days was the cruise?
A week.
And how many times did you perform?
I performed three times solo. I organized a Woody Guthrie event. I saw who else was on the bill, Mary Gauthier, Cassie Chambers, Justin Tanzel. I kind of knew these guys would be into doing something around Woody. And also being a little bit political, I wanted to kind of make a point of doing something of that ilk. And I gave a talk about skiffle because I thought that audience who are into their roots music would be interested to
hear. Well, you wrote,
I did.
You wrote a book about skiffle. Yeah. Now, I understand this was really a big thing in the UK and it inspired a lot of rock artists, but Americans are clueless. Not that I haven't heard from English listeners, but relatively briefly, explain what skiffle is.
Skiffle is English schoolboys in the 1950s picking up acoustic guitars to play Lead Belly's repertoire.
And okay, I don't know if this is too deep because we always hear about Liverpool being a seaport city and a lot of the acts from there getting American records from the seamen. How did these skiffle players find out about Lead Belly?
Well, in the years after the Second World War, the American government had a department called the U.S. Information Service. And if you went to the U.S. Embassy in Grosvenor Square, there was a department there where you could go and borrow books, American books, so promoting American culture. In the basement, there was a record library which contained the whole of the Library of Congress recordings. So everything from, American classical music, Copeland and stuff like that, all the way to the Parchment Farm recordings that Alan Lomax did with Muddy Waters. And so people like Lonnie Donegan, who had a hit with Rock Island Line, Lead Belly's Rock Island Line, could access those records.
And that is how they found them?
That is how they found them.
Lonnie Donegan actually went to the record collection?
Lonnie Donegan didn't only go to the record collection, he regularly stole the records because people would go there to borrow the records and they would say, I'm afraid this record has been taken out by someone called Tony Donegan. Donegan realized that if he stole the record, the Americans could just get another copy. You couldn't buy a Lead Belly record in England. So he often stole the records. And when I went to the Library of Congress in 2017 to talk about skiffle, they looked in their records and found a memo which discussed the fact that books and records were being stolen. And the attitude in Washington, D.C. was, well, we're trying to promote American culture. I guess this is part of the process. Let's not worry about it.
I guess it's working. They had a more enlightened attitude.
Exactly. So here's the thing. Donegan has a hit with Rock Island Line.
What year was that?
56. Mm-hmm. He goes on the road in late 56 playing vaudeville circuit. So he's doing two shows a night, six nights a week in major cities. When he plays in Liverpool, George Harrison goes every night of the week. Paul McCartney goes. John Lennon, we don't think he does go. Here's the really significant thing about this. Harrison is 13. McCartney is 14. And Lennon is 16. These are the people that Donegan has the effect on, not people who are buying African-American roots music from sailors in the port. We're talking about kids. In some ways, skiffle was like the fidget spinner craze that has been in playgrounds over here in my country in the last 5 years. It was a schoolboy phenomenon. What they did, those kids, was they picked up the acoustic guitar as a symbol of their difference from their parents' generation. Because these kids, John Lennon's born in 1940. He's in the first tranche. They're our first teenagers. And until 1954, when Lennon's 14, there was food rationing in my country, including sweets. So John Lennon couldn't go in a sweet shop till he was 14 and buy what he wanted. And a year later, he left school and, you know, was going to college. So he was quite almost an adult before he could buy what he wanted. And it's these kids and their young, their lives being deprived of those things that glom onto African-American culture so strongly as something that's theirs. It hasn't been handed down to them by the state or rationed to them by the government and the BBC. So they learn to play guitars. And so by the time American kids, white American kids anyway, are learning to play acoustic guitar during the folk revival, which starts in 59, Our kids, their contemporaries, who are the same age as them, they're already in Hamburg. And the result of this is that when the Beatles break the American charts in January 64, there's a huge number of already road-hardened British groups ready to come in behind them. Skiffle is the nursery for the British invasion of America. It's not what they did in the 50s, these kids. It's what they do in the 60s that counts.
So you were born in 57?
I was born at peak skiffle, yeah, 1957.
Okay. Were you aware of any of this or you're too young?
No. When I was a kid, I was aware of Donegan, but only in terms of his novelty records, like Mile Man's a Dustman and just your chewing gum loses
So what, flavor. When did you get turned on to
around music? The time of punk. Because what happened with punk was all the old guitars that had been there during skiffle, which were mostly old arch tops, were back in the junk shops. And the old, really early hollow body electric guitars in the UK, which were made by the Hofner Company, they were all, you know, you could buy them for 10 quid. And they became kind of part of punk because they were so fabulously retro. And punk had a lot of similarities with skiffle in that it was a do-it-yourself genre. You know, you made your own music. You, in many ways, you were self-empowering. Because that's the thing that was most revolutionary about Donegan. The message that he took around the country when he went out in 56 was, firstly, you don't have to be a trained musician to make music. And secondly, you don't have to be an old African-American guy to sing the blues. And this is probably the two most revolutionary ideas ever imparted to British youth. It was just, you know, because Van Morrison, when I interviewed him for the book, told me the problem with Elvis was you couldn't be Elvis if you were British. It's just impossible. You could be Lonnie Donegan. So Donegan kind of was the catalyst for these kids to learn the three chords necessary to play all of Leadbelly's repertoire, which also by coincidence happened to be the three chords necessary to play all of Chuck Berry's repertoire.
Okay, and the punk scene, you know, it starts in America with the Ramones in 75. They don't get any traction. When do you become aware of the punk scene?
77. When I go and see The Jam, they were kind of retro band.
Where were you? Okay, so where were you living at the time?
East London, a place called Barking in northeast London, an industrial borough. I was educated. I left school at 16. I was educated to work in the car factory, which has dominated our town.
Okay, a little bit. Once again, if you leave at 16, what do your parents say about that?
Oh, they're cool. My parents had both left school. So I have a working class upbringing. My parents
and
didn't.
And so do you go to work? What is your gig? You go to work in the car factory?
No. I'm determined not to work in the car factory because we get from school, we go to the car factory every year for careers advice. And when I tell the careers officer that I don't want to work for Fords, he says, you've three options, son, in the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. That's it. So I manage. What happens is just as I leave school, the Port of London is being containerized. And so I get a job with one of the new container companies. as a kind of office boy, which is kind of more or less what I wanted, you know. Because in many ways, I kind of picked up the guitar to avoid working in the car factory, because they were the main ways to escape: be good at football, good at boxing, or play music. And I wasn't good at the first two.
Okay, let's go back a little bit. So if you're turned on to the punk scene and you go to see with the Jam in 77, are you someone who's addicted to the radio before that?
Yeah, from the age of about 12, I had a reel-to-reel tape machine.
And I used really?
To, yeah, I sort of a domestic one, domestic okay. reel-to-reel. I think my parents realized if they bought me a reel-to-reel machine, this is before the days of cassettes, I'd be able to tape stuff from the radio and they wouldn't have to keep spending money buying me records. It's quite clever, really.
And is that what happened?
It was better than that. My friends down our street all had elder sisters and their record collections were just brilliant. So very soon I had the entire Simon & Garfunkel catalog and Motown Chartbusters volumes 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 on tape. And that provided me with the basis of my knowledge of music and my skill as a songwriter.
And when do you start to play?
I start writing songs when I'm about 12, 13, but I can't play until I leave school.
Okay, but if you're writing songs, you're writing them on what?
Paper.
Well, really? Yeah, just making the melodies
yeah,
up in your head?
In my head, yeah.
And are those Moon June songs? Or?
Well, I wrote a poem at school that when I was 12 that the English teacher was very impressed with, and he wrote to my parents and asked if I copied it from a book, and I hadn't, so that impressed him. And then I got to read it out on a kids' radio program, a local radio program. So it kind of
okay. Let's go a little bit slower here.
Yeah,
was this for an assignment?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and you remember what the assignment was?
Write a poem.
Okay, and was this relatively brief, or you know,
3 or 4 verses? Yeah,
3 or 4 verses. You remember any of them today?
Not really. It was kind of apocalyptic in its nature, I think. That you know, there's no hope for mankind or something like that.
Okay, and was it something you dashed off or something you took seriously? This is my chance.
It's something I did for homework, Bob. It just worked out really well. And that kind of, and then I failed all my exams except the English.
Wait. You get to read on the radio. That must be big, you know, it was a big inspiration.
It inspired me. because I always liked singer-songwriters. You know, I started with Paul Simon and graduated very quickly onto Bob Dylan. I had a job in a hardware store on Saturdays, and the hardware store had a record shop in the basement, so I spent all my money on discounted vinyl. And early on, I got Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits, the original version, which has all the early stuff on it.
Right.
And that really inspired me.
Okay. So you're writing songs. Are you gathering together with friends to play these songs?
Well, this is the thing. The kid next door, when I turn 16, I can hear the kid next door playing his electric guitar through the wall. He's 14, and he's working his way through the Rod Stewart songbook. So I get my dad to buy me a nylon-strung Spanish guitar, and I get the kid next door to teach me how to play the Rod Stewart
songbook.
Although
I remember that's how I started in a nylon string. They're not easy to play.
No, they're not. And it's, you know, it's the just thing of get one hand to do this and the other hand to do something completely different. It's not easy. But as I say, I was learning songs I really loved at the Rod Stewart songbook because he covered Dylan and he covered, you know, a lot of great songwriters. So I was quite into these songs. And
let's stop here for a second. A lot of punks had a negative attitude towards what came before.
Mm.
Were you part of that?
I was when it got to 1977, yeah. I was a year zero kid. Although it wasn't everything. I remember I gave all my Eagles albums to the woman in the post office who I liked. She was a good friend. She was into the Eagles, and I used to see her, and I was like, I've got to get rid of these. I cut my hair. I got some narrow leg trousers, got rid of my flares. But by this time, I was in a band. I was playing.
Okay, but let's go. So you hear the electric guitar through the door, through the wall. You buy the nylon guitar. Then what?
Well, me and the kid next door, Wiggy, we play in the back room. A friend around the corner who we went to school with was a year older than me. He plays drums. We start, you know, hanging out. We become a little gang in my back room. We're predominantly playing the Faces, the Stones, a lot of old rock and roll songs. And writing our own songs as well, writing a lot of
in
our
that
own songs.
Stripe.
Yeah. Right. It's like an apprenticeship, you know.
Right.
I worked out how some of the Faces songs were basically guitar riffs that they just attached words to rather than verse chorus things. And I explained this to Wiggy, And he came up with riffs, and I just attached words to them. Like, so they sounded like.
And where is Wiggy today?
He's living still where we grew up, not very far away. His dad still lives in the house next door to the house I grew up in, although since my mum passed away, my nephew lives there now. So I see him quite regularly.
Okay, so you're playing. Are you playing out, or are you just playing?
No. Nothing like that. We're waiting to be discovered, Bob. We're trying.
The dream is intact.
Yeah.
Okay, you think that I can make it.
The dream is forming. The dream is forming. And it's punk.
Well, I saw you move your hands. Does that have something to do with the money? Is that the dream or is that money?
It's traction. It's traction. Okay. Some kind of traction for a dream. Dreams need traction. It's punk that makes us realize that the way to be in a band is to be in a band, not to wait for someone to come and tell you to be in a band. Going to see The Clash, more than so than The Jam. I don't know why. I think The Clash was they did all the things we liked to – The Rolling Stones, but they were our age. So we kind of, some of us more than others. I think I was more into it than the other.
Well, that's my question. You're forming this band, and did you quickly realize, wait a second, I have more desire than the other
people? No, we all had the same desire. We just didn't want to have the same haircut. And I think that's always a problem in a band. But what happened was, in the summer of 77, we decided we all wanted to go on holiday together somewhere where we could stay up and make music all night. Couldn't do that at our parents' house. So we found this rehearsal studio, demo studio out in the country. And we went there for a week.
Out in the country is where?
In Northamptonshire.
Which is how far from East London?
Oh, I would say it's 2 hours, 3 hours.
Okay.
You know, but rural, completely rural. You know, nothing for miles around it but fields and forests.
And what is paying for this?
Oh, we're all at work by then. You know, okay. I'm 19 in 77. Wiggy will be 17. Bob will be 20. So we're all at work. And we kind of went to the studio and never really came home. After going back and forth there a few times, the people who ran it were really great for us because they gave us the confidence. You know, that week I must have written a dozen songs while we were there. And we did stay up all night. And we did.
Why did the people give you confidence?
Well, because our parents were like, you know, we might as well have been collecting stamps. As far as my parents were concerned, it was a hobby. And I should get a proper job, you know.
Okay, but, so at this point, you had the office job, office boy down at the docks. How long did you do that?
The office, it was in the centre of London, in the city of London. It wasn't down the docks. I think maybe by then I was even a bank messenger. I think I'd moved up. I was a bank messenger.
And you're still living at home?
Yeah, the crucial thing that's happened since getting the first guitar and going to the studio is that my father's passed away. In 1976, when I was 18 years old.
That must have really fucked you up.
It did. Well, it kind of did, Bob. It was a long time coming. He had lung cancer. But as he died and I had to sort of get to grips with not being a kid anymore, punk happened. And punk became the sort of life raft that I sailed away from my childhood and that terrible period where my dad was getting worse and worse and worse and worse. It was almost like everything stopped in my life, just stopped. While that was going on, and then it ended, and there was punk was there, and I was able to step onto that and sort of row away to the next part of my life. So I was very fortunate in that.
Okay, I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun, such a great entertainer, and that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid-back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th, just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Bring along the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies to add a sprinkle of joy to your workday. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
If you're 21 years old and use nicotine or tobacco, I'm here to tell you about Black Buffalo and how it's redefining tradition for millions of adult consumers. So if you're over 21, consume nicotine or tobacco, and want to join the Black Buffalo herd, head over to blackbuffalo.com to learn more. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Black Buffalo products are intended for adults aged 21 and older who are consumers of nicotine or tobacco.
Okay, so you're working as a bank messenger, and you're making music, and what's the next step?
Next step is that we move, all the guys in the band, we decide to move to the farm, to the studio, except the guy who has an apprenticeship at Ford's. He decides to stay at Ford's, which is understandable. And we live up in East Northamptonshire for 18 months.
And you do what for a living?
Nothing.
So you're living off what?
Off the government's unemployment benefit.
Okay.
Which in those days was not a bad thing. A lot of people were on the dole. So the taxpayers kind of pay for my apprenticeship. That's why I don't mind paying my taxes. I think it's only fair to pay some back. We had a great time up there. We were legendary in that town.
Although, and you obviously played live there.
All the time, yeah. We had a residency at a pub, Sunday afternoon residency, where local punk bands would come and play. And in that town, in that community, we were the punks. But we meant absolutely nothing outside of that community. But they were great people, and we really had it's very formative. My old manager, Peter Jenny, used to say that I didn't go to university. I went to Riff Raff. That was the name of the band. and that is indeed true.
Okay, a couple of things. Didn't you go in the military at one point?
That's what happens next. Okay. The band breaks up.
Why does the band break up?
Well, we had to move back to London, and the drummer wanted to stay there, and me and Wiggy wanted to go back, and so we got a couple of other guys in, but it wasn't the same. It just wasn't the same. And the venues we played in were disappearing, and a new breed of pop stars was coming along who put style over content, and we'd always been content over style through punk rock. And in order to get gigs, you had to have a synthesizer and a funny haircut, and I've never had either of those. So our time had come and gone.
And did you literally give up the dream, say, you know, time passed me by, I didn't make it?
I kind of joined the army to press the eject button on my previous existence. That was the aim of it.
Now, if you join the army, theoretically, you could get your ass shot off.
Well, yes and no. Depends what you do. I mean, basically, at the time, the only place you'd get your ass shot off was in Northern Ireland. But I told them I didn't want to go there, so they put me in an Irish regiment, because the Irish regiments didn't go there, because you don't want to take some guy off the streets of Derry and teach him how to shoot and then send him back to harass his neighbours. It's not a good idea. So I kind of mitigated against that. But the terrible thing is, Bob, that once you've driven one tank, you've driven them all, to be honest with you. So,
well, let's start from the beginning. Did you drive a tank?
Yeah, for a while.
Really?
Yeah.
And you're saying, I just want to understand, because, you know, I grew up in the era of the 60s when we were all anti-military.
Yeah.
It's hard to see it flip in front of my eyes now. But are you saying there was no room for growth, personal growth, or you're saying what?
What, in the army?
Yes.
No, there was a realization quite early on that this wasn't going to cure me of wanting to be a singer-songwriter. In fact, it made me want to write more songs. So because we have a volunteer army, you can buy yourself out.
So, at any time?
It gets harder the more trained you are, but I bought myself out more or less at the end of basic training. So I'd barely driven a tank.
And how long was basic training?
All in all, it was about 4 months.
Okay. I got to ask, though. You're in the army. Can you relate to any of these people?
Well, a lot of working class lads like me were nowhere to go. You know, in those days, if you couldn't read and couldn't write but were physically fit, there was a job there for you. Now, you can't do that anymore. They're not.
Okay,
not
so you buy yourself out of the army, the dream is rekindled, and you do what?
I spend a year working out how to start doing gigs again solo with an electric guitar, start writing songs in that style, and playing anywhere anyone would have me for nothing, just carrying a little practice amp.
And then, did you have a day job at that time?
I was very fortunate, and I bumped into an old mate of mine from the basement record store in the hardware right. shop. He was running a record shop, and he gave me some work.
Okay, and you got to listen to the music too.
I did, yeah. Okay, it would interest you because it was an entire chain of records, record stores that sold only cutouts.
Really?
Yeah. There was a guy had a big church in the
East End. For those people who don't know, back in the days of physical, when something was deleted from the catalog, when they weren't going to manufacture it anymore or they had overstock, they'd literally put a cut in the cover and they would sell it at a discount. And there were no royalties to the acts to boot.
That's right. And so he had, and he hired me, the boss, because I was the only one who knew anything about punk. And he would take me to bankrupt record stores and ask me to value the punk stuff. Look at the punk stuff. Because wow. he knew the other stuff. He didn't know shit about punk. So I would have to go in. And one day I found one of our records, a Riff Raff record, which made me laugh. But I'd get a lot of the stuff he had was white labels. You get boxes of white labels, and I would spend a lot of the time during the day in the shop while there were customers in the shop playing the white labels, trying to work out what they are and writing on them what they are and selling them for, you know, a quid or something. So it was good. The dangerous thing was going to the warehouse. You know, if you went to the warehouse where the records were kept, another thing from the days of physical, your listeners might not know how heavy records were. There was always a danger that there could be an avalanche of copies of All This and World War II, the soundtrack. You could get buried under them because there were a lot of those in the warehouse. Do you remember that record?
Yes, I do.
Exactly. Okay, so, yeah, so that was, those were the days. Those were my days in the bowels of the record industry. And right. all this entire chain run on, you know, the
– what was the name?
Low Price Records. Run on nothing more than the detritus. He ran a whole – I think he had six shops run just on the detritus of the record industry.
Well, I got to ask because that's the second word you used, which if you're an American – that would be evidence of higher education. You said, as you pronounce an inclement, we might say inclement here, and you said detritus.
Yeah.
Would these be words come up casually in the UK, or are you separate from the average working man?
Oh, no, I'm a wordsmith, Bob. So I do have a, you know, fabulous collection of archaic words because I need them to rhyme with things. But by saying detritus, I was trying to suggest that these songs, these records weren't rubbish. I got some great white labels.
No. I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, usage is not the issue. It's just you don't get the average musician using those particular terms. Anyway, you're playing and you're slinging the cutouts. And what happens after that?
I start to, the guy I work with, who's also a musician, he's a bass player in a jazz funk band, Steve Goldstein. He buys a Porter studio, which is like a little recording deck that you can make.
Well, people don't know, there are four tracks on a cassette, usually two in each direction. And I don't know if TIAC was the first one.
Yeah,
there was, you know.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, and they used all four tracks in one direction. So it's kind of like recording in GarageBand today, but on a primitive level.
Very primitive. But he bought this and he was so excited about it and he wanted to test it out. So he invited me to come and make some demos at his mum's flat where he lived. And I was totally up for this because I was writing loads of these solo songs. So I went along and demoed my songs and I sent them to the Melody Maker, which was a weekly newspaper, one of four we had music papers in the UK.
So it was Melody Maker, NME, Sounds, and
Record Mirror.
Okay.
And they had a page called Playback where they reviewed demo tapes, and a guy named Adam Sweeting gave mine a fabulous review. Absolutely.
Did you think it was as good as his review?
I had no idea, mate. But I can tell you that when my then girlfriend, who worked in the West End, so got the newspapers a day early, and we got them in the suburb, the music papers, read it to me over the phone, I almost wept. I'll tell you why, because it was the first intimation I got that I might actually be able to do this job and it might work. It really was like a validation, the like of which no review has ever had. In fact, just I'm tearing up a little bit now just thinking about it. That moment, it was. I just closed the shop, so it must have been around 6. Sun was setting, so the shop was full of beautiful light. And it was almost like, you know what? This might actually happen. It might actually happen. So it was... It had my phone number on the bottom of the review, and I was phoned by a guy who worked for Chapel Music Publishers, a guy named Jeff Chegwin. He invited me to come and make some demos. Nobody else there was particularly interested, but he gave me a day in their demo studio with their engineer, We recorded a dozen songs. And around the same time, I had a residency in a rather sort of rough spit and sawdust joint called The Tunnel in Southeast London, a pub. And I was doing pretty well there. But I started sending this, the original demo tape that I'd made on the Port Studio, I'd sent it out to record companies, but not got anywhere. And I started going to record companies and going in reception, and I'd get a few names and try and ask to see someone. I didn't know anybody. And I went, on one day, I went to Charisma Records. I was looking for a guy named Peter Jenner.
Okay, I mean, I know Peter Jenner, original manager of Pink Floyd. Certainly you're a manager. Did you know who he was at that point?
I got his name from a guy who painted backdrops for The Clash, who I knew.
Okay.
And when I said I was looking for a manager who was political and like a father figure, he said, I know a bloke like that, Peter Jenner.
That's so, who he is.
Yeah, exactly. And it was in my career. But at the time, he was A&Ring for Charisma. So I went there with my demo and I asked for him at reception. I was sitting there and I was not really getting any, looked like I wasn't going to get in, same as everywhere else. When someone put their head around the corner and said to me, are you the guy who's come to tune in the video? Now, at the time, I was working with Wiggy.
Right.
Sort of part-time. Wiggy was doing audio-visual presentations for companies. And not many companies, this was 1982, maybe, 1983. Not many companies had video machines. So we would take a video recorder with us. And while Wiggy was doing the warm-up, I'd crawl under the telly and tune in their TV to this video machine. So although I wasn't the person who had come to tune in the video, I was capable of tuning in the video. So without a moment's thought, I said, yeah, I am. So she said, great, come this way. Took me into the recording, to the record company. Crawled under their telly, tuned in their video. I think they were watching Peter Gabriel, who was on the first edition
of the Tube. So you actually did do the show?
Yeah, for sure. It wasn't a complete blag.
Right.
I'd done it. So I don't feel guilty about lying because I did do it.
Right.
All right? Let's get that straight. And then I said to, we were all standing around watching, I said to this woman, is Peter Jenner about? She said, yeah, it's him over there. So I went over and laid my tape on him. And bless him, he came to see me at the Tunnel.
Okay, did he play it while you were there?
No,
okay.
But he came to see me at the Tunnel. And he later said when he came to the Tunnel, there was an electric atmosphere in the room while I was on stage. He spoke to a woman at the bar, and she said I was brilliant. And when I finished, because he was late, he'd gone. There's two tunnels under the river. He'd gone through the wrong one. So he was in typical Pete style. He was late, so he didn't see the gig. He just saw the end of it. But he said to me, "We must do something, however trivial." That was his line to me as he left, because he left straight away. What he didn't know was just before he'd arrived, there'd been a fight, and the reason for the electric atmosphere was I was trying to hold the room, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Stop it breaking out again. The woman he spoke to at the bar was my then girlfriend. So. And amongst all this, we kind of, and only got sacked. He got sacked by Charisma after he put the record out. He put the record out and he just gave me 25 and said, see if you can get any radio plays on that. I'm like, I thought this, you're supposed to do this. He said, get out. Go to the BBC. So I went to the BBC and I left some copies. I left a copy for John Peel.
Right, famous DJ.
Most famous DJ. And the nighttime DJ who had the ability to break bands and give you sessions. I left it there, and that night I was in Hyde Park, which is the other end of Oxford Street from Broadcasting House, playing football with some mates. And afterwards, we were having a few beers, and we were listening to the BBC, the programme before Peel, which is Kid Jensen. And Peel came in to talk about what was on his show, and he said to Kid Jensen, I would do anything for a mushroom biryani, which is a form of a curry. So a light went on in my head. So I went down, I walked down the back of Oxford Street, bought a curry, bought a biryani, went to Broadcasting House and said to the concierge, curry for Mr. Peel. They rang him. He come down. He physically come down to take the curry off me. So I was able to say to him, my name's Billy Bragg. I left a record for you today. Life's the Right Spy versus Spy. It'd be great if you could have a listen to it. He's like, fine, sure. Took the biryani. I tuned in that night. Not only did he play the record, he said, thanks very much for the biryani, Billy. I would have played it anyway. And it was the beginning of a I'd like to think of a real friendship between myself and the great man.
Okay, so now you have your start. Is it a relatively, you know, it's hard to do on the radio, talk about graphs and angles. Is it steady going up, or is it ups and downs?
It's about ups and downs to start with. Because Charisma, the record label, is taken over just after my record comes out on the Utility label. The record label is taken over by Virgin. So everything goes sideways, including my record. But a guy named Andy McDonald ran a label with a woman called Leslie Simmons, and together they rescued my record and re-released it later that year. And by the time we get to the new year, it's number one in the independent charts, which was a big deal in those days.
How do you think it got there?
Well, partly because of I was really, really working hard doing gigs. Peel was playing it. He put New England in his Festive 50, in the top five, I think, his Festive 50. Andy and Godis were doing a good job with it. He was a good promotion man. Him and Leslie did a really great job on it. And Pete Jenner, you know, was old hand. So it was like a collaboration.
But everybody put their effort in.
Yeah, my willingness to do as many gigs as they threw at me and to go, and literally, I literally was out on the road with an amp in one hand, a guitar in the other, and a pack on my back on trains, because I didn't drive then. And my agent would just set me up with support acts for bigger bands, and I would just try and steal their audience. So by the time we got to Christmas, I was doing my own headliners.
Okay, that record is successful. What's the next step?
America. I get a shout in this August 1984. Do I want to come to the United States of America and open for Ed Kind of Bunnymen on their first American tour? So I do. So I'll call Wiggy, say, Wiggy, this is it, mate. I'm going to tour America for a month. I may never do this again. You've got to come with me. You've got to come with me. This is what we dreamed about doing. Come on, let's do this. So I'll pay for it. I'll pay you to do it. Come and roadie for me. Play a couple of songs. Get on the back of the bus with the Bunnymen. And that's what we did. We went coast to coast, north to south. It was just amazing. And to do it with Wiggy, it really was. For me, it was the sort of culmination of that.
Exactly
sort of
the word
dream.
I was thinking. Exactly. Culmination.
You know, we went, we got to Los Angeles. At the end of the tour, the Bunnymen went home. We were there for a couple of days. We rented a car, drove to the end of Sunset Boulevard, end of Route 66, and walked down to paddle in the Pacific Ocean and had a moment like our sort of 16-year-old selves kind of saw us there, or we saw them. And we came off we all got very emotional, me and Wiggs. The sun was going down. And we saw, as we came off the beach, an English pub, which was just too good. So we went to go and have a pint to celebrate, and they wouldn't let us in because we didn't have ID. Totally killed it. We're like, you don't have to have ID in an English pub. No ID, no.
Okay, so, at what point do you make a deal with Elektra?
Oh, that comes shortly thereafter. Pete, because I go back to America about three times in the following year, and Pete gets me to deal with Elektra on Taxman, I think. It's okay. Taxman, so 85, 86.
Okay, so in this period, we will call it your heyday.
Yeah.
Do you achieve your goals?
Yeah, I do. I meet lots of very interesting women. I have very interesting conversations with them with no clothes on. That was one of my goals. I'm not ashamed to say.
Wait. So you're not a closer, you said?
No. Without any clothes on, Bob. I'm trying to put it in a nice way. One of the reasons why I wanted to be in a band was to impress girls.
Right.
So, you know, that kind of.
That worked once you're on stage. We know that's a established formula. But one has to ask, I mean, you're a very verbal guy. Was your act working before you had some level of fame on the stage?
Yeah, it was. Okay. It was working. But the guitar and the English accent really kind of helped.
Okay, any of these women you have contact with today?
Yeah, I do. Quite a few of them, actually. I like to think I've remained friends with quite a few of them, you know. It's what you do when you're in your 20s. You know, that was my kind of period of heightened sexual activity. What happened to be on the road, so it had a double-edged sword to it, because I was learning a lot as I was traveling as well. You know, it wasn't just me in one particular area. It was a great time to be out on the road.
And at this point, are you touring solo mostly?
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Okay. And then you ultimately have a backpack amplifier.
No, I don't ultimately have that. Pete Jenner dreams that up. as a way of getting people's attention. It's a complete pain in the ass because it weighs a ton. It feeds back, and it's the most of the weight is across your diaphragm. It's like a backpack, so you can't really get a lung full of air. I complained about it mercilessly. It gave me a bad back. But Jenna, damn him, said at the time that, yeah, but people will remember this, Bill, and your comment there.
Right, exactly. That
annoyingly proves him right.
Okay, so the downturn in turn, you know, everyone's got a relatively brief window where they are the center of attention. Now, would you say the moment passes, or you would say the internet comes and decimates the
scene? No, the moment passes. Basically, my height of that would be working with in the UK with the Labour Party around Red Wedge and the miners' strike. That very political opposition to Margaret Thatcher and her policies, and in the US to Ronald Reagan. And that was kind of that's what defines me for a lot of people still, and I'm cool with that. I don't mind being called a political songwriter, although I write more love songs than I write political songs. My problem is being dismissed as a political songwriter. People thinking they know what I do. You know?
Did you grow up in a political household?
No, not really. No.
So how did you become, inspired to speak out on your political views?
It's all down to the inspiration of one person. I'll never forget her name. It was Margaret Thatcher. Of my time. If you look at my first couple of albums, the politics is personal. Just because you're better than me doesn't mean I'm lazy. Taxman, I'm writing songs called...
That's a message we need more today than ever.
Yeah, exactly. But by Taxman, I'm writing There Is Power in the Union. I'm writing songs called Ideology. What's happened is the miners' strike has happened. And for my generation, the miners' strike was a very...
Why don't you expand upon that for those people?
In 1984, the Conservative government provoked the National Union of Mine Workers into a year-long strike that ultimately... led to not just the defeat of miners, but the defeat of organized labor in my country. And it was both destructive of unions, but also destructive of communities and spirit. It broke the working class spirit in my country. And so, having grown up listening to all those political singer-songwriters in the 1960s when the strike happened, I thought, okay, well, this is where I get to find out if music can change the world. So I did everything I could to use the talent that I had and the platform that I had to make the case for not just sort of organized labor, but for a compassionate society, which is what Thatcher was opposed to.
Did you run up against internal pressure not to do that?
Yeah, of course. One of Thatcher's ministers used to complain to the BBC if they put me on air. You know, he's a guy named Norman Tebbit complained.
And how much, once again, you're in a different marketplace than America, and we're very ethnocentric and self-obsessed. How much exposure do you get in that era of the miners' strike?
Quite a bit, really, because we've got to remember, we've got four weekly music papers. And during the strike, everybody was talking about it. It was not something you could avoid. So... young people were galvanized by opposition to Thatcher in the way they've been galvanized by opposition to Trump and opposition to Brexit. So to be a young person and to be making culture for young people, I wasn't alone in the way that I'm
well,
kind
were
of...
Were you political before this, or just this issue struck you in such a way that I got a big statement?
I was personally political, Bob. You know, my politics were broadly, anti-racist. I'll be honest, before the miners' strike, I didn't have much grasp of sexism. It was that experience that introduced me to those issues. But I've been politicized by Rock Against Racism. So that's where my politics kind of came from. But the ideological politics, so I started, the miners' strike caused me to define myself as a socialist rather than just someone who was in favor of good things. And I started trying to, bring that in. And for a lot of us, it was definitive.
Okay, we're in a very tumultuous globe at this point in time.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of rightward movement, although recently a little bit of a pushback to left. Do you have hope for society at large?
Yeah, of course. As I say, I describe myself as a socialist, and unless you can see that the glass is half full, you can't really be a socialist because you have to believe if the majority of people have a say, that the things will work for the better. You've got to be able to wake up in the morning and think that, broadly speaking, humanity leans towards a much more compassionate society. And you know, I think we live in time. We live in a time when there's like a war on empathy coming down from on high. You know, anyone who expresses any sort of, you know, respect for people outside their own racial or cultural or ethnic group is sort of dismissed as virtue signaling or political correctness. These people who use those terms are trying to police the limits of social change by their dismissive language, and we have to take them on as best we can.
Well, war on empathy, that's a good way to put it. So what is really going on with Brexit? You know, prior to this being published, I'm sure there'll be other movement, but give us the insight into how this happened.
Brexit is a manifestation of the inability of the neoliberal economic model to deal with change. And it's not isolated. I think the election here in the United States of America in 2016 was also, the election of Donald Trump was also a result of the other candidate, Hillary Clinton, being unable to offer any real change, economic change that will help ordinary working people. She couldn't do that. She was just offering more of the same. And people, if you've not benefited from the economic model, then the impulse to protect that economic model by voting to remain in the European Union, forget it. You know, you've made my life a chaos. I'm going to make your life chaos now. And I think that's the lesson from Trump and Brexit, is that unless ordinary people are offered meaningful change, they are willing to vote for the kind of, you know, damn the lot of you chaos that we see with Brexit and with Trump.
Okay, so now that the election, or the Brexit election, is essentially 3 years old, there's been a lot of talk about people who just, and a lot of working class people who literally voted against their interests because there were plants in their societies that were funded by European Union. They talk about a nationalism that people missed, a national identity, believing in the UK. Mm. To what degree is that a factor?
Well, I'm a socialist, and as a result of that, Bob, I know there are many different types of socialism. It's not just one type. You know, you have democratic socialists here in the United States of America, the social democracy. It's the same with nationalism. You know, in my country, we have the British National Party, who are led by a man who denies the veracity of the Holocaust, and the Scottish National Party, who are more left-wing than the Democrats and the Labour Party. So, you know, nationalism is not always a negative form. Civic nationalism, loving your country and wanting it to be better, is not always negative. But what's going on, I think, both with Trump and with Brexit, is an attempt to return to the way things were before women, people of colour, and the LGBTQI community made their inroads.
How much of it is that, and how much of it is what you stated earlier, the lack of economic opportunity?
Well, that the one is a reaction to the other. You know, the big slogans from Trump and Brexit were "Make America Great Again" and "Take Back Control." It's not like a moving forward idea where we're all going to move together. We're going to go back to how things were before all these uppity people got their place in society. It's almost a nostalgia trip. And in my country, it's underscored with imperial nostalgia. And I fear in your country, it's run through with a nostalgia for Jim Crow, I'm sorry to say. Now you can put that down to nationalism if you like. There is a nationalist element in there. But nationalism isn't always negative. But what is clearly is negative is people who don't feel that they have a place in society anymore. You know, some of the Brexit people say that they don't feel that Britain is their country anymore. Now, I have some empathy for that because I felt that way during the Thatcher years. So I'm not willing to dismiss them all as being racist, you know. Not everyone who voted for Brexit is a racist, but every racist definitely voted Brexit, I tell you that. But the point being, you know, these are people who don't feel their voices heard anymore. And Brexit was their opportunity to be heard. And I think there's an element of that within the Trump vote as well. And the question then becomes, how do we accommodate those people?
Okay, so how do we?
Well, I think we have to give them the thing that seems to be lacking to me in their lives, and listen to what they say, is a sense of some agency over their environment. And one of the reasons for that, I think, in fact, the prime reason for that, I think, is that the lack of accountability in a voting system in your country and my country that doesn't make everyone's vote count. If we lived in countries that had proportional voting systems where every vote results in representation, we might be able to get to grips with some of these issues. I mean, what's been happening just recently in my country with members of parliament splitting from the two main parties is the stress being put on a system that is unable to accommodate meaningful change.
Well, let's go back just for a second. Go a little deeper. Proportional voting meaning?
Proportional voting meaning that the members of Congress will proportionally reflect the number of votes counted.
Okay? In their election or in their viewpoints expressed?
In their election, in the number of votes counted. In my country, we have a system called first past the post. So if there's three of us, let's say there's three of us in the election and I get the most votes, I win, even if I don't get the majority. You know, if I get, let's say I get 40% and the two other candidates get 30% each, I win. And what happens to the 60% of the votes that are against me? They go in the trash. That's, you know, you keep doing that for 20, 30 years, those people who go in the trash every time are going to get angry. Well, I live in a rural constituency, we call them our parliamentary constituencies. I live in a rural community where the Conservative Party have been the MP since 1886.
1886?
Yeah. And where I live, in East London, where I grew up, rather, Labour has been the Member of Parliament there since the borough was created when my father was a child in 1920-something. So I'm a Labour supporter, but I recognise...
Okay, just talk about the constituency you live in now. Is there any opportunity for Labour or a third party?
No, the second party, even. Previous elections, I've had to campaign for the only party, the party that comes second, even though I don't support them. I've had to encourage people to vote for them in order to defeat the Tories and to stop the Tories winning at Westminster. It didn't work. But in a fair voting system, our votes would be reflected. You know, there will be a threshold. Parties that got more than 5% would get some kind of representation. They do have it. I mean, most European societies have it. It's not a solve all your problems, but it does ensure that everyone's votes get respected.
Okay, that's talking about government. What about economics in the fact with, you know, a lot of the economy, certainly in America, is driven by technology, and there aren't enough jobs, never mind well-paying jobs for people.
Mm.
How do we address that?
Really easy, Bob. Green New Deal. You know, the New Deal that Franklin Roosevelt used in the 1930s to re-engage American workers, greening the American economy would have the same job. Because although, yes, technology will be important, you will physically have to change the way that, you know, every house is insulated. You will physically have to change the way that automobiles work. You will physically have to change the way power is generated. These are all labor intensive.
Well, right. Well, those would cause employment for a period of time, just like the Alaskan oil rush of the 70s. But it does not speak to the billionaires who ultimately control these large corporations and wield their power to the detriment of the working class and middle class.
Well, we're back to the A word again, Bob, accountability. You know, I think this, I've just been proofreading a polemical pamphlet I've written, a 15,000-word pamphlet about accountability, because I believe very, very strongly that it's going to be published later this year. I believe very, very strongly that our obsession with free speech as the definition of freedom is to the detriment of other dimensions of freedom that are equally important, and they are equality, the right of everybody to express their opinion. More importantly, though, accountability, because it's accountability that gives the individual agency over those corporations that you're talking about. So I'm in my book, I'm arguing that equality and accountability be given equal prominence and equal respect that we give to free speech.
Well, let's say, you know, there are certainly bad actors in corporate world, but there's a spectrum So for those people who are paying, those corporations that are paying their taxes but still eliminating jobs, what's the accountability there?
Well, the accountability there is that the corporations have to be responsible so that the profits, some of the profits that they have to go into the communities where they work to create space and create a sustainable model of growth that helps those communities in some way. If everyone, you know, if maybe we go into a four-day working week or something like that. Because the real big problem is that the globalization of the economy has made it possible for an extractive model of capitalism that allows a corporation to make its money in one country and then pay taxes somewhere else.
If
they pay them at all. And unfortunately, the only way to deal with that is to have some kind of global deal. And again, unfortunately, voters tend to be shying away from that kind of international collective action that the European Union...
Well, as I say, you know, globalization is here to stay. And it's just like in America, no one wants to pay $4,000 for a flat screen if it was manufactured in America. But there hasn't been a good trickle down or understanding for those people left behind.
Trickle down doesn't really work, Bob.
As I say, economy, that's what I mentioned.
The economy works not by entrepreneurs making loads of money and trickling it down. The economy works by you and I and every other average Joe and Jill going out every day and buying stuff. That's how the economy
of course.
Was. That's what the New Deal was about. The New Deal was about putting money into the pockets of ordinary American workers so they could buy automobiles in America, so they could buy fridges, so they could buy houses. If you don't have these people at the bottom spending their money, that's when the economy collapses.
Well, that's one of the things that bothers me. You have all these corporate titans. It's all based on consumer spending. Mm. They didn't make the money in a vacuum.
No. So the question is then, how do you get that model to be sustainable? How do you get it to be more accountable? And I believe you do that by giving the consumer, the individual, greater agency over the process. So that involves a form of regulatory democracy. More regulations, not less regulations.
Well, in America, and I agree with you wholly, the right wing has done an excellent job of demonizing the word regulation. When, of course, no one wants to live in a building that collapses, etc. But, you know, maybe there's change now, just like when Nancy Pelosi, they demonized her and they, you know, it turned 180.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun, such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid-back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Bring along the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies to add a sprinkle of joy to your workday. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
If you're 21 years old and use nicotine or tobacco, I'm here to tell you about Black Buffalo and how it's redefining tradition for millions of adult consumers. So if you're over 21, consume nicotine or tobacco, and want to join the Black Buffalo herd, head over to blackbuffalo.com to learn more. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Black Buffalo products are intended for adults aged 21 and older who are consumers of nicotine or tobacco.
Brexit. Now, the hard Brexit is what, March 23rd?
29th. Yeah, I mean, that's driven by deregulation as well, just add.
Right.
It's driven by the people behind that who are pushing hardest for it, exactly those kind of people, extractive capitalists, who are trying to get out of the European Union because the European Union is now starting to pass laws, which you'll know about copyright and such issues that are, have international implications for corporations, not just manufacturing corporations, but people like Facebook and Google.
Okay, so how do you predict this will play out, Brexit?
Well, Brexit, Bob, mate, it's like trying to say who's going to win the World Series in 10 years' time. It's everything you say you think will happen doesn't happen, or something weirder happens. It's really – what Brexit has done, it has totally fractured the idea of left-right politics completely. So you can't predict anymore the way people are going to respond to issues in the way that you could before. Brexit is like a fault line that runs through our politics, and it's in some ways a bit like Trumpism in that way. You know, it's split families and it's split. I mean, I know people who don't talk to their parents anymore because their parents voted Brexit. It's impossible to predict. I think it's likely that the British government will have to ask the European Union to postpone.
Kick the ball down the field.
The field, yeah. There's a thing called Article 50, which is the process that we're in at the moment. That could be extended. What I would like to see is an independent review of it. A lot of people at home want there to be a referendum, another referendum. Bob, that referendum was the most divisive day in British post-war history. The most divisive day. And you want to do it again? Come on. You know, it makes winners and losers. What we need is a consensus. So the Irish recently convened a people's forum to decide the issue of abortion. They put people, ordinary citizens, elected like a jury. I think there was 100 of them. And they took evidence from experts. No politicians were allowed to talk to them. They took evidence from experts and submissions from the general public. They deliberated for months in a hotel every weekend. It was all broadcast online so people could see the deliberations. And they came up with recommendations which the Irish government then ratified and put to a vote. And the vote of the Irish people was the same as the vote of the public forum, which is more or less 65% in favour of abortion and 35% against. Now, what that did was, A, it involved everybody in the country in a debate. It went on for a period of time, and the conclusion was consensual. Everybody could say that everybody's voice had been heard. Whereas the referendum on one day, on one vote and one outcome has not resolved an issue that has divided British politics
for
a long time.
What about, the issue of all the misinformation?
Yeah,
the original Brexit vote. Would this process eliminate that?
Yes, because we would then have to put those questions to the test. Before, Brexit was an abstract. Now, this close, we're starting to see the lie of the land. So, yeah. But, I mean, the fake news thing is also part of the accountability agenda. You know, the loss of accountability anymore. I mean, and it's not just that that the neoliberals don't want to accept facts. They don't want to accept being challenged. One of my real problems with the so-called intellectual dark web, these freedom of speech warriors, is that they simply will not countenance a challenge. It's not free speech they want. It's free reign. They want to be able to say whatever they want and have no comeback. And that's the difference, and this is the key difference between liberty and freedom. Liberty, the idea that you can say whatever you want to whoever you want, whenever you want, and you know, not be held accountable for it. If that was the definition of freedom alone, then your president would be the paragon of freedom, because that's exactly what he does. But it's not the definition of freedom. It's actually what he's doing is an abuse of his freedom. He's using his privilege in order to make those points. And you need equality, everybody's right to express their point of view. And then on top of that, you need accountability, the ability, you know, your ability as an individual to hold people to account, but also your willingness to be accountable yourself. It's reciprocal as well as empowering. And these things are lacking. This is the case I'm trying to make in this this pamphlet, The Three Dimensions of Freedom.
Just to be clear, so you're against this political correctness?
I don't believe political correctness exists, Bob. It doesn't exist. You know, it's a projection of the powerlessness of people. You know, if you look at the people who are most angry about political correctness, they tend to be academics. And what they're pushing back against is people bringing in different metrics with which to deal with subjects. I think what's the academics are afraid of is that the standards that they were raised with that have allowed them access to places of privilege, if the metrics are changed, they will no longer be able to just walk through those doors that the rest of us are kept out of. They are defending their own privilege. You know, there is no such thing as political correctness, and yet your president was elected after saying that he thought political correctness was the thing that was the biggest thing that threatened America today.
Okay, let's switch in gears a little bit. Where does this leave you, Billy Bragg?
Oh, it leaves me with a platform. That's what this job has always given me, a platform. You know, bottom line, Bob, I think I'm a communicator.
So you're 61 in a change universe from when you started, primarily because technology, means of communication. What do you envision going forward, the 20 or 30 years hopefully you have left on this planet?
Cool. Oh, let's hope. I'm hoping that...
This is personally for your career.
Personally for my career. If I carried on doing what I'm doing now, which is more or less what I was doing in the 20th century, I'd be happy. I mean, I feel immensely privileged, Bob. I've been coming to America for 35 years, and people are still interested in what I'm doing to the extent I've sold 3 nights out at the Troubadour, and I've got other shows like this lined up. You know, and that's down to a number of things. You know, my management gave me good advice, and I took it. My agent, Steve Martin, has been with me all the time, and, you know, he has a great vision for what I try and do. And my sort of urge to try and communicate, try and make sense of the way the world is, as still motivates me. You know, it's just that I think what's different now is that there are other ways, there are other platforms. So to sit down and write a book, it kind of gets, you know, sort of after 35 years, you need a break from touring around in a van. That's why I went on the Kiama cruise as much as anything, you know. 35 years driving around America in a people carrier, I'm ready for.
Okay, but also getting your message out in a Tower of Babel society where it's harder for any voice to be heard, is that a weight on your shoulders?
Not mine, no, because I'm fortunate in that I got an audience together in the days of college radio when the music industry was stratified. There were people at the top who were making huge amounts of money playing stadiums. There were people at the bottom who were going to open mics. A lot of us were kind of in the middle, you know, making a living, never going to trouble the top of the charts, never going to play the stadiums, but could go out there and play the circuit and follow. You know, it's a very 20th century thing. I have a son who's in a band now. He's 25 years old. There is no middle ground anymore. You either busted through and have gone gangbusters, or you're playing for a pittance somewhere. That sustainable middle of the road where record label lets you make 3 albums to see how they work out, that model is absolutely shot. And I'm sorry about that, because although I don't necessarily want there to be another Clash or another punk rock, I just wish every 19-year-old could feel like I felt when I saw the Clash and then go out and be able to make a living on their own creativity. That's what's missing. You know, all of the new pop stars that are coming through in the UK tend to have been privately educated, which means in my country means they're not working class kids like me and almost everybody else in British rock was in the 20th century. And that's my real concern. If, you know, the ability to have a career in music or any creative industry just becomes the preserve of the upper middle class, then we will really lose something important in the experience of life for our young people.
You've been listening to Billy Bragg on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. We could literally go on for hours, both through his catalog and through politics, but we don't want to weary either the audience or Billy himself out. Billy, it's been wonderful to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me, Bob. Been very, very interesting.
Okay. A lot of stuff that we touched, a lot of stuff that we haven't touched, but you've certainly been very stimulating. Question, I'm a big believer that one person can impact society. You know, we're seeing that with AOC in America changing the debate. And musicians used to be the people who impacted society most. Not right now, no. But we can hope it happens again.
Well, the thing that's happened, if I can just finish off, Bob, on that, is the thing about AOC is she is organized. The key is if you want to change the world, you can't just sing about it. You got to get organized. That's the key thing about AOC. And for all the work I do, in the end, in my experience, only the audience really can change the world by going out there collectively and working together. And AOC is a really good example of someone who's an expression of the collective will of her people and hopefully of the American people.
Let's just go back. The book that you're writing, what are your plans for that?
That will be coming out in May, maybe in August in the United States of America. It's like a pamphlet. It's 15,000 words. It's an essay, really. That's just making the point that accountability ultimately is what's missing in
this will be
debate.
Sold or given away
it'll
for
be sold.
Free?
No, it'll be sold. It's by Faber and Faber, a British publishers. They published my Skiffle book. They're doing a series of them. It's their 90th anniversary, and they're doing a series of them, and they've asked me to write the first one.
Do you remember who the other people are?
They're mostly musicians. They're mostly people working in the creative industry.
And will you be promoting it in addition
to Faber? I will indeed,
Faber?
Yes.
Okay. Till next time, you're listening to Billy Bragg on the Bob Lefsetz Podcast.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man, and being a country megastar while also having 7 kids, you know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
This is Amy Brown from 4 Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.